her willingness to graciously let us be part of her home. She asked me to introduce David. He was a very difficult interview subject, so luckily I'm married to him, so I know a few things. He was an item he often kept hidden is he was born in Utah, but he only spent the first minutes of life there, and then moved on to a few misspent years in Portland, and since then lived in Twin Falls, Idaho, and it's Idaho he calls home, and relates to in those areas and where his siblings still live. He went to undergraduate school at Columbia in New York City, which is where we met. Spent a mission in Brazil, graduate master's degree at Harvard, medical school at GW, George Washington, in Washington, D.C. And has since then spent a great deal of his life living in various parts of the coastal regions of the U.S. and also in Italy, as he participated his career in the Navy for a bit of time. He is now practicing medicine in Tacoma, and where he's chief of OBGYN with group health there. His hobbies, for a long time, his hobbies have been his children, but now our daughter's married last year, and next year our son will be, so now looking forward to other things. I have hobbies I think we might be best, some running, having done a marathon this year in Portland, and reading, does a lot of reading, partly because another very strong belief of his is in public transportation. He takes a bus a lot, reads a lot. Let's see, I tried to get his favorite authors, probably, P.G. Woodhouse at the moment, and Ian McEwan has been another important book. And let's see, what do you look forward to in life at the moment? I would say what he looks forward to in life was where he's not at all involved in any house remodeling or doing anything that helps me in the garden. And with that, I'll leave you to give your talk.
In some ways, I think this century may be come to be known as the era of overblown technology, whether it's cold cell fusion or fuse cells or smart bombs. And today it'll be projection and computers. I don't have the right cable. I have a wonderful slideshow here, mainly because I have some beautiful pictures of cells and microscopes, but I can't show them to you. So I'm going to have to revert to I don't know, 50 years ago when we actually had to write on chalkboards and paper. So we'll see what that brings us.
I'm going to hold that up for you.
Well, I think it'll rest against this.
Okay.
Not quite ready to begin there. Although, I'll see my slideshow, so I'll...
I see the slideshow. You are missing so much.
Gave it that stand will bend down. Oh, it's almost flat.
Oh, great. The title of my talk is I think it'll balance now.
Okay, I'll get a wrench anyway.
I may. Can it lower?
Yeah, it goes up a bit.
My title originally was The Ethics of Stem Cell Research. But that's not correct. It's The Ethics of Embryonic Stem Cell Research. And that's the big deal of it. Nobody objects to stem cell research. Like nobody objects to research into glucose intolerance and diabetes. But it's the use of embryonic stem cells that fuels the debate. We have to begin with a little bit of cell biology. All cells contain this, not all cells, virtually all cells contain the same DNA, the chromosomes, which are, let's call it a recipe book that's in a kitchen. The kitchen's a cell, and the recipe, this big thick recipe book are the chromosomes, the DNA. One kitchen will produce, the kitchen will produce beef stroganoff. Why is that? They're looking at different pages in this recipe book. In the same way, even though kidney cell has the same chromosome as the skin cell, this kidney cell is on a different page in the skin cell. So all cells have this potential. The word that's used in the literature is that cells are, or that the genes or chromosomes are switched on or switched off, different segments of them. So the skin cell has one segment switched on, that all the other parts are switched off. The mechanisms involving these switches, as you might expect, extraordinarily complex. Not much is known about it. Once cells are mature, it's very hard to unswitch them, which makes sense. You don't want your kidney cell to unswitch itself and become a skin cell in the middle of the night. So that's very good. But it does pose problems for research. I said virtually all cells have this chromosome material. A major exception are the red blood cells, the cells that carry oxygen from in the blood. Red blood cells have no nucleus. They have no chromosomes. Because of that, they can't renew themselves. They can't replicate. Well, but red blood cells only live for a few months. So something has to give a rise to new blood cells. And what does this, or what we call the hematopoietic stem cells? Thank you, Banna. Say, over here.
Okay.
Hematopoietic poietic stem cells live in the bone marrow, the soft living tissue inside the bones. And they give rise to three different types of cells that are totally different. Red blood cells that just contain mainly hemoglobin, grab on oxygen and let it go. White blood cells that fight infections, and platelets that cause platelet clot. So three really different types of cells and functions all come from these stem cells. Stem cells...
A little higher. Can't see it.
So we need to define stem cells. Stem cells are immature. That means they don't actually produce anything. They'll self-renew and they can replicate and duplicate all the time. And they can differentiate. Stem cells are like medical students, non-functioning, immature, but with great potential to become whatever they want to become. Dermatologist, radiologist, whatever. Not yet. Now we have to leave cell biology and go into embryology. You notice on the back of the sheet there's some a glossary to help with some of these terms. We start with a sperm entering an egg. That happens in the fallopian tube. We call that conception or fertilization. It creates a zygote. Zygote sort of gets itself together for several hours, maybe 20, 30 hours, and then starts to duplicate. At that point, it becomes an embryo. And just for definition, embryo is the organism from fertilization to about 8 weeks. After 8 weeks, we call it a fetus. Everybody needs something like Roy right
there. Visible from over there?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
There are certain milestones, and this is, I don't have a, it's too complicated, but it's really important. We return to this about, talk about ethics. Day three of life, of course, life in quotation marks, but day three after fertilization, we have what's called the blastocyst. It's the first time that you see some differentiation. For the first day or two, when the zygote replicates, each cell is just like the one before. 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8. But when you have the blastocyst, you have the first differentiation. And basically, it's two parts, one of which will become the fetus, one will become the placenta. But that's the first. On day about 5 to 12, the embryo implants itself in the wall of the uterus. Until then, it's free-floating. On day, let's say we'll call it day 14, after conception, after fertilization, you have the first real individuation, specialization, a lot of the term is often used called gastriculation, and you have different cell types. Some will become skin, some will become nerve cells or kidney cells, whatever. And that's at day 14 when you really begin to see a differentiation. Week 7, heart beats, fetus moves. By week 12, all organs are totally formed. Week 12 to 40, it's just growth. Everything's formed by week 12. Week 24, there's about a 25 to 50% survival rate outside the womb. And that's stem cells. The big deal about stem cells is they're used in medical therapy. Most diseases have the risk of something gone wrong with how cells work. In diabetes, cells don't make insulin. In Parkinson's disease, nerve cells don't make dopamine. In cystic fibrosis, cells in any gland of the body make really thick mucus instead of really thin mucus, and so things get clogged up. I don't know when it first happened, but someone said, would it be fine if we could replace those defective cells with new cells? Stem cells could be those new cells. We can find a way to get them into the body and have them differentiate. I need to back up a minute. I talked about the hematopoietic cells being able to go into red blood cells or white blood cells or platelets. How do they know to do that? If a person loses a lot of blood, they have to make a lot of red blood cells. If there's an infection, a lot of white blood cells have to be made. How do these stem cells know which way to make it? Obviously, they're responding to some type of external stimuli. Stem cells do that. You put a stem cell in the brain, it's going to respond to factors in the brain and function accordingly. So that's how you can get with this notion that if you just have these stem cells and get them where they want to go, they'll respond to local environment factors and then do their thing, grow new nerve cells, grow cells that make the right type of mucus and so on. So that's the magical promise of stem cells. And you can list the number of diseases that will be cured by. You can make new heart cells for damaged heart, you have heart attacks. It's just tremendous. Even cancer is the one study said, well, cancer is not a problem with defective cells in the sense that cancer cells that know no growth. But the basic use of stem cells now is like leukemia. Person has leukemia, they get chemotherapy, which destroys all blood cells, good and bad alike, malignant cells, non-malignant cells. And then you put stem cells back in the bone marrow that make new red blood cells that are non-malignant. And that's basically the paradigm for the current use of stem cells. So even for cancer, you can have stem cell research, although you have to precede it by destroying all malignant cells, but then you have new stem cells to replace what was lost. So it's almost hard to think of a disease that you can't use stem cells for. But we need stem cells. So the next issue is where you're coming from. And this is the other sort of key point here. Adult cells and embryonic cells. Adult cells can be either came from the cord blood from a newborn baby, and this was easy to mix up. The word adult can refer to cord blood cells or to other parts of the body. I said marrow, the bone marrow here, but there are many organs in the body that have stem cells. It's debatable whether all do, but that's another issue. So you have adult stem cells and we have embryonic stem cells. Where do embryonic cells come from? In vitro fertilization, infertile couples can have, the woman can receive drugs that cause superovulation. Instead of one egg cell being produced every month, 5, 10, 15, I don't know what the max is, 20 cells can be produced. These are taken out of the ovary, mixed with sperm in a test tube, resulting in a number of zygotes, which are allowed to nurture again in a test tube, and you have embryos. Because of the difficulties of all this, it makes a lot of sense, just in terms of economic efficiency, to have a lot of embryos formed at the same time. So a woman that goes through an IVF cycle may have 5, 10, or 15 embryos. A number of these are then implanted in the uterus, hoping that enough will survive to have one or two babies. But you have a lot left over. You may want to use them in the future, so you freeze them. Embryos can be frozen and thawed. Not all of them survive that process, but enough to it makes it worthwhile. It's estimated that in the country right now, there are 400,000 frozen embryos, some of which could be used for research. We're bordering on the ethics now, but we'll defer that for a minute, whether or not they can be, or will be, or should be. But even though that's a huge number, by the time you eliminate the stem cells or the embryos that will be used again by the couple, eliminate the stems or the embryos that you don't have permission to use, the ones that don't survive the thawing, you may have only a couple of hundred that are actually useful for research. That's an important number when we talk about the politics and the science of it all. Now, there's another source of stem cells called somatic cell nuclear transfer. Take an egg cell, withdraw the nucleus. Then take the nucleus from a mature cell, skin cell, liver cell, whatever, put it inside the egg. It'll become a zygote and an embryo. Now, if you think that through, that sounds a lot like cloning. In fact, it's called therapeutic or research cloning. But that's how you get embryos for stem cells. Problems with stem cells. They have to be renewed. You have to be able to grow them. You have to replicate. Easy inside the body, very difficult outside the body. They have to have growth, a soil to grow in, a matrix. Right now, all the current federally funded stem cell lines are grown in a matrix of animal cells, which means they could never be used for human research because of rejection and immune problems. That's one of the reasons why people think they need more stem cells. Mutations occur at the rate of 1%. Most mutations are harmless, but over time, every time there's a new generation of stem cells, there are more mutations. Eventually, they wear out, which is another reason why there has to be a renewing source of stem cell lines. Malignancy, stem cells can be unstable, and instead of specializing and stopping once they get to the right level of specialization, they keep going, and that's a malignancy. Adult stem cells can be contaminated by viruses. Adult cells can have a problem with immune. My stem cells won't work in you, so if I have some nice neural stem cells and you have Alzheimer's and I try to put my stem cells in your brain will reject them because you're different than me. Now, I've reached the end of biology, embryology, and stem cell research. Any comments from either people that would like to correct any mistakes I've made or basic questions about the basic research? If not, we'll go on and talk about the ethic perspective. Yes?
It's not clear to me somehow what a stem cell is. You talked about where the sources are found. Can you just review that?
A stem cell, think of it as an immature cell. In cord blood, for example, out of 10,000 red blood cells in the cord blood of a fetus, one will be a stem cell. So you have that type of proportion. That stem cell is immature. It doesn't function, but it has the ability to reproduce itself, to replicate, and it can differentiate into different types of cells. So it can become a red blood cell, white blood cell, and so on. So stem cells are immature cells, few in number, that have the ability to differentiate. Like the medical student, when he becomes mature, can become a radiologist, a pathologist, a dermatologist. So stem cells are immature cells, undifferentiated, but have the ability to differentiate. Mature cells can't. Once you're a kidney cell, you're always a kidney cell. But stem cells can become anything they want to become if the right switches are pulled.
And does the body produce these continually in different places of the body?
Yes. It's uncertain exactly whether all organs have stem cells. You can identify stem cells in the brain. It's questionable whether they occur in the pancreas. You can identify them in the GI tract. Not a lot is known, but they're there. Yes?
On adult stem cells, did you say all the lines that we talk about currently, are being grown in animal?
Actually, the big controversy came in like about 2001. Stem cell research is just a handful of years old. First embryos were created from IVF, frozen embryos. Stem cells are taken out of the embryo, like around day seven or eight. Stem cells are taken out. And this is before they've had to differentiate. They're still all the same. They're taken out of the embryo. That means the embryo is destroyed in the process, or lost, if you want a less majority of time. These stem cells from an embryo, from a discarded embryo, comprise the embryonic stem cell lines that are the subject of the controversy. These stem cell lines, at the time, they couldn't grow them except on an animal matrix. They didn't know how to grow them otherwise. So all the current, and then at that point, President Bush said, federal funding will not be used to create any more. Well, it was a compromise. We'll allow the current ones to exist. They're already done. It's done. Water in the bridge. But I won't allow any more new stem cell lines to be produced with federal funds. So when you hear about the current embryonic stem cell lines, they're several years old already. They're produced on they grow on animal matrices, which means they can't be used for human research, and they're deteriorating with time. They're not going to be good for that much longer.
So does that mean then that if they find any use out of this research, that nothing could be done with these current lines to benefit humans out of the current?
Correct. They're strictly research. Adult stem cells can also be grown, but very difficult. I'm not too sure anybody really has a stable self-replicating stem cell line that comes from adult stem cell. Very hard to do.
They can't use federal funds for that. It's going to be done through private research.
Yes, but you know what? Drug companies don't want to do that. You know why? They'd much rather let the federal government do it for them. The basic research that drug companies use is done by universities. Then they capitalize on that. So drug companies could do it, but they don't want to. Yes.
What's the quantity? I mean, if you're going to use a stem cell, do we know how many stem cells it would take to, say, correct diabetes or Alzheimer's? I mean, how many do you need to withdraw?
No, I don't want to go there.
Know that?
I don't know that. Okay. I mean, theoretically, one could do it, but, you want a whole lot. So we have to move on quickly. I'll collect the questions, but we're going to run out of short time, so please go ahead.
With hematopoietic stem cells can be transplanted into a different recipient.
Yes.
If the haplotype is a close enough match, is that correct? Am I using
that?
Is that not the case with the other types of stem cells, like a nerve stem cell?
Same problem. You always have, if you haven't, you always have the problem of immune rejection. It's more of a problem the more mature the cell is. So adult stem cells have more of a rejection problem than embryonic stem cells. Although your own stem cell, if I have one healthy nerve cell anywhere, or a stem cell, they could be taken out and replicated and then put back in, then maybe I can solve my own Parkinson's disease.
But there
without
is
a rejection problem.
But there is there a chance that a different person's cell may work for you, but there's a high chance it might.
I always
not.
Have rejection problems.
That's why they have matching programs for
kids. But there is, it's never perfect.
Yes. When you say grow stem cells, do you mean to reproduce themselves without differentiating?
Yes. And that's what makes it wonderful. They replicate themselves. They don't differentiate. So each new stem cell will be another new stem cell. If subjected to the right factors, then it'll differentiate. But the great deal, the great potential, it's only a potential of embryonic stem cells is they can continue to self-replicate themselves without differentiating. But I can't overemphasize how early the research is. It's just very early. I mean, 10 years from now, it all may be a bust. Or 10 years from now, it may meet some of its potential. But 10, 20 years, I mean, it's so early. Where you get annoyed at the politicians that take advantage of this and say, you know, vote for me, I'm going to support stem cell, like, so that tomorrow your uncle's going to be have his Alzheimer's cured. And, you know, decades away, I would think, for most of the application. But we, you know, once again, don't forget people now are being cured of leukemia with using their own stem cells. So it's not a, there's some there. But most of the problems are long ways away. Yes?
Do you think that it's smart to privatize research, because now that it's privatized, there isn't like government keeping track.
The question is, wouldn't it be smart to privatize? No, you don't want to privatize.
Because then the government doesn't know what they're doing.
That's one of the arguments for federal funding is you still maintain some type of public oversight. If you allow stem cell research to go under private grounds, it's much more difficult to control, and that's one of the main arguments. Okay, general ethical principles that we're going to be talking about. I'm not trying to give you a total view of all ethics. I'm not an ethicist, but it's things that we'll talk about here. A human life can't be used as a means to an end. Period. One would hear people trying to justify slavery, saying, well, but slaves are better off now than they were wherever they came from. No, slavery is bad because it uses human life as a means to an end, whatever the external conditions. There has to be respect for life. You notice one of the questions I asked you there referred to different ways of respecting for life. Anybody here a vegetarian? Let me simplify vegetarianism really simply. There's two reasons to be a vegetarian. One is health. It's healthier to eat vegetables than meat. Number two, you don't want to use animals, to kill animals for food, which is a respect for life. Out of a, what would you say, and I'll put you on the spot here.
thank you.
Is your vegetarianism 80-20, like 80 respect and 20 health, or is it 10 health and 90? What would you say on that?
I'd say there's a third reason, and I'd say that's because my parents are... I don't want to say hippies, but it's true. I was raised this way.
Okay.
And her father is a moral vegetarian, I'm more of a health vegetarian.
Okay.
She's a 50-50.
You're a 50-50. But there is a respect for life there. I've read some wonderful explanations of kosher food laws, explaining how it's not so much health or tradition, but it's a respect for life, because they specify how the animal has to be slaughtered, and it's the emphasis on the humane slaughtering of animals is what makes it kosher. Another ethical principle, the greatest good for the greatest number. And finally, it's not so much an ethical principle as it is, but it is, and that's a slippery slope. A slippery slope refers to the fact that once you start down a path, you may not be able to return. For many people, Vietnam was a slippery slope that would lead to communist takeover of Asia. Marijuana is a slippery slope to drug addiction. My passing a donut shop is a slippery slope to gaining weight. A TV is a slippery slope to the moral degradation of our children. we all use slippery slopes. It's hard to justify rationally because, you know, this doesn't have to lead. Marijuana doesn't have to lead to drug addiction. But with children, with ourselves, we deal with slippery slopes all the time. We're worried if we take that one step, we may never come back. John F. Kennedy was a slippery slope to Catholic takeover America, right? So it's easy to make fun of slippery slopes, but we all use them, and they guide a lot of our lives. Okay. I'm going to do some reading now. First of all, you'll soon recognize where this came from. In pitching my tent, we found three rattlesnakes, which the brethren were about to kill. But I said, let them alone, don't hurt them. How would a serpent ever lose his venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition and continue to make war upon it? Men must become harmless before the brute creation. And when men lose their vicious dispositions and cease to destroy the animal race, the lion and the lamb can dwell together, and the sucking child can play with the serpent in safety. But that's the Joseph Smith in Zion's Camp, showing a respect for life. Now, let's try to use these general ethical principles in talking about embryonic stem cell research. Remember, embryonic stem cell research means taking stem cells out of an embryo, thereby destroying or losing that embryo. And what ethics are involved in that process? These are some principles to include. Number one, embryos do have a moral status. They're not just an object. Embryos have a moral status. Now, the moral status may not be the same moral status as a person, but they have a moral status. Number two, there should be no other way to gain the same results. And this is a respect for the life, respect for the life of the embryo. If you can get the same information any other way, do it. There's a similar approach is about using animals for research. It's easy to use animals for research, but if you can get the same information in another way, don't use animals. But there's some ways you have to use animals for research. At least that's a little controversial, but we'll say that same idea. This is really difficult, and the one that's hardest to understand. The ethical scientist that's trying to justify from an ethical viewpoint his use of embryos for research will say, it's okay, because I'm using it before gastrulation, before day 14, before this individuation. I'm still using it when it's just a cluster of cells. The development of the embryo and the fetus is a continuum. Trying to find a line where it's different below the line than after the line is very difficult. But that you'll see that a lot. Being this day 14. Before day 14, all the cells are the same in the embryo. After day 14, the cells are now different, headed to become skin cells or kidney cells, whatever. But before day 14, they're all the same. That process called individuation or gastrulation is considered critical in the moral standing. Embryos can't be considered property. They can't be bought and sold. Going back to the respect for life again. Just like organs can't be bought and sold. The control or the disposition of the embryo has to remain in the hands of those who provided the gametes for the sperm and the egg. They're not the property of the scientist again. Public finding, you referred to that earlier. Public finding maintains public oversight. And there has to be a sense of loss. Now, I don't really know whether the scientist in the lab, when they extract the stem cells, pauses for a minute to regret the loss of that embryo. There has to be some of that in there. Now, what I've just outlaid on these two pages are what I would think an ethical scientist would use to justify research into stem cell, the use of embryonic stem cells. Now, an ethical scientist that opposed stem cell research would give the following arguments. An embryo is a human life, period. Pressure from the pharmaceutical industry will lead to buying and selling of embryos, just like there's underground buying and selling of organs, if not in this country, certainly in others. And finally, stem cell research is just one step short of cloning. Stem cell research is a slippery slope.
and do we want to go down that to cloning and whatever that leads to. Now, moving on to religious perspectives. The Catholic perspective is well known. Fertilization creates a human life due to all the legal and moral status and rights of any human life. The zygote, 1 minute after fertilization, is as much a human being as anybody. Second, one human life cannot be sacrificed for another. You can't sacrifice the human embryo, no matter how many millions of people may benefit from the research involved in that sacrifice. Jewish perspective, very interesting. And this is, you know, there's a lot of different Jewish traditions, but I'm taking what I'm saying here from consensus from the National Orthodox congregations and from testimonies before Congress by Jewish leaders. Number one, the embryo in Jewish tradition has no moral status until 40 days after implantation. Sage and I were trying to speculate, you know, number 40 is a very important Jewish tradition. Sage thinks that the 40 may come from the 40 weeks of gestation. Anybody else have any idea why 40? Well, why, you know, 40 years in the wilderness, 40 this, 40 that, 40 days after implantation? Does it all relate back to the 40 weeks of gestation? Sounds interesting. Number two, in the Jewish tradition, life begins with birth. Number three, there's a mandate to save human life whenever possible. And number four, in the Jewish tradition, there's a huge, a great latitude permitted for learning. Learning is important. Knowledge is important. The Muslim perspective. Legal and moral status is accorded to the fetus after the arrival of the soul, which is at the end of the fourth month of pregnancy, about the time the fetal movement is perceived. And again, in the traditional Muslim faith, there's a mandate to save human life. Now, the Latter-day Saint perspective. I'm going to read a lot of different perspectives. Bring me on. Quote, when the mother feels life coming to her infant, it is the spirit entering the body. So Brigham Young said, the spirit enters the body at around 20 weeks gestation when the mother first feels the baby move. In the mid-1950s, President McKay and his counselor, J. Reuben Clark, talked to Seminary Institute teachers gathered at BYU. The talk was published by the church under the title, Man, God's Greatest Miracle. And in it, President Clark set forth an argument drawn partly from the Holy Scriptures in support of the belief that the spirit does not enter the fetus much before birth. So that's President McKay, J. Reuben Clark in the 1950s. 1982, from now Apostle, I don't believe he was Apostle then, 1992. I'm not sure. He may not have been Apostle when he wrote this, but he came from an article on the inside. Quote, it is known that life begins when two germ cells unite to become one cell. The onset of life is not a debatable issue. Russell Nelson. And this is a church statement made in July of 2001 at the time of the big controversy. It was interesting. Part of the issue then, well, not the issue then, was again, should there be further federal funding? The five Mormon senators all supported it, much to the consternation of conservative and Catholic politicians. The church also supported this statement. Stem cell research, quote, merits cautious scrutiny. As with any emerging new technology, there are concerns that must be addressed. Scientific and religious viewpoints both demand that strict moral and ethical guidelines be followed, period. Pretty much an open door for embryonic stem cell research. And that was 2001. Senator Smith from Oregon, one of those five Mormons, testified before Congress in 2001. He cited the following from Genesis. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And then he continued with his own testimony, quote, this allegory of creation describes a two-step process to life, one of the flesh, the other of the spirit. He then went on to compare stem cells to the dust of the earth. They are essential to life, but standing alone will never constitute life. As Smith portrayed it, the onset of life, which is a union of spirit and body, takes place when the embryo is implanted in a womb. So Senator Smith, whatever standing he has, is he still senator? Is he running this year? Or is he, he felt that life, or that spirit enters the body when the embryo is implanted in the womb, which is around day 7 or 8. Now I'm just reading from a silent town. I didn't know who wrote it. Mormon teachings support the idea the spirit loses its intended body. No, I'm sorry. Mormon teachings support the idea that if a spirit loses its intended body, for example, through a miscarriage or an abortion, God will provide another opportunity for this dead spirit. That is, no spirit will be consigned to hell or otherwise lose its opportunity for full salvation simply because a fetus was aborted or an embryo destroyed in stem cell research. We have in our theology loopholes to say that spirit will have another body made ready for it. And there are a lot of couples who have stillborn babies who have encompassed the idea that the spirit that was destined for that stillborn will come into another body, if not with those parents, with another. Mormon doctrine holds that each person lived as a spirit child of God prior to being born and receiving a physical body on earth. From this point of view, it makes no sense to say that life begins at conception. Life doesn't begin or end. Life is eternal. Instead, Mormons would say that life on earth begins when the spirit and body are united. Life on earth, but not life. Life is eternal. All right, we have 7 minutes left for discussion. But I think we may take a few more minutes. We did start. So I'd like to open up to your views on what you think about the ethics of embryonic stem cell research. Should we do it? Should we not?
Yes. Just one more quick clarification. You have to destroy the... You can't... Is it possible to extract a few of the stem cells without destroying...
That's a good question, because it is possible to extract a single cell, analyze it, and decide whether or not certain diseases exist, and still have the embryo go on. That's extraordinarily difficult, but it's possible, and that may be a future role. You just get one stem cell out and manage to have it replicate, duplicate until you have a lot. That process is viewed with great alarm, because it's one thing to say, we'll have this embryo extract just one cell, and there's still 10 or 20 in there that continue to replicate, analyze the DNA of that one cell, and find out whether that cell has cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome. And if it does, discard the embryo. If it doesn't, go on. The concern is that a lot of people use that information to say, this is a girl stem cell. Let's destroy the embryo. Or this stem cell is only going to be 6 feet tall. We want a 6'4" child, so we'll discard the embryo. That's not science fiction. In India today, and I suspect a lot of other countries as well, but it's really well spread in India, ultrasounds are done. If fetus is a girl, it's much more likely to be born than if it's a boy. So, right now, I've not seen that actually being suggested as a potential. I agree it's possible, but whether you can still save the embryo and do it, I don't know. Yeah.
David, both the question and the statement are confusing statements. The question is there merit to diversity in the collective number of stem cell lines that are pursued? I'm aware that just between myself and my mate, there's potentially almost, a mind-boggling number of potential conceptions, because we make so much sperm and so many eggs. Is it possible to get there by replicating just from, a couple of lines? Because you could, the idea of making babies out of all those is mind-boggling. Four was enough for us. But you could do hundreds of thousands, if not millions. I know women make fewer eggs than men sperm, but still, it's a whole bunch. Is it necessary to have a collection of a wide spectrum of cells from different partners in order to achieve what's necessary out of stem cell research, or can you do it from a small pool?
The more the better. You may have stem cells that, because of that particular genetic composition, are going to be better able to produce dopamine to cure Parkinson's disease. Stem cells may be more resistant. Some stem cells may be more resistant to the factors that cause Parkinson's in the first place. So yeah, the more the better.
In the ethical side of the argument then, what is kind of the tone of the conversation around the fact that nobody makes living humans out of all the potential number of sperm and egg combinations that can be done? Nobody suggests that can be done. And yet they're there, they can be harvested, they can be utilized. What's the ethical argument around that issue?
I'm not too sure what you mean. I mean,
the rest of it's just wasted.
Yeah, but...
Do Catholics, for example, object to even making all these potential people and only implanting two of them?
Yes. Oh, IVF is strictly against any Catholic, the official Catholic doctrine. No question about it. Sorry, condoms. Well, yeah.
What condition does the cell have to be in? And my question is about the miscarriage embryos. Last year I had a miscarriage at 12 weeks, and I asked if it could be donated. And she was so grateful because she said, you know, we can't ask you. It has to be volunteer. You have to say. So if where are we right now as far as research? So if an embryo is donated, what's happening? Are things stopped? What's going on right now when things are donated? Embryo is donated from a miscarriage.
The woman's eggs, yes, but she still ovulates every month. The sperm cells, at the point where the tube is cut, the sperm get up to that point and they'll get any further, but there's some still maturation beyond that, so that may be more difficult for a vasectomy. But certainly, the woman's having tube size, the eggs are still there and can be harvested.
Okay, now my next question. Is there still the ethical problem? They make the decision, no more kids.
No. Any time you create an embryo, you have either life or potential life, and that's the ethical dilemma. One more over here.
Two questions on cloning. Are any people making the argument that cloning will give us the opportunity to prove this two-stage process, that there's a physical part and a soul? You have identical physical pieces, but the differentiation would prove that there was a soul in there. And then the second point, that it seems that people are opposed to cloning because you're trying to optimize a certain genetic set. And I'm wondering, do people have the same objections? I mean, we'll probably get into it later, with our church prohibitions or arguments against interracial marriage. There are a lot of things that go on to select for ideal genetic sets anyway, they're just not as explicit as cloning. And people say, you know, you're just doing a more magnified version of what's happening anyway.
So
does anyone make the argument that we could prove that souls exist by cloning? Or does anyone say, look, we're trying to optimize genetically through evolution, through who we choose by mate, who we want our sons and daughters to marry? We're going to do this, it's just a magnified version of that cloning thing. We're not really that much farther down the slippery slope.
Identical twins have the same genetic material, but we presume have different souls. So I think the thing about it is, even if you have the same genetic material, even in the womb, the two identical twins have different influences. One may get more of a blood supply than the other one. And that results in a different growth patterns, which results in a different person. So even though you have different chromosomes, even at birth, identical twins are different people. Clones would be the same thing. I mean, you make a clone, but once it's grown, it's subject to different environments, and that makes it a unique individual. In terms of differences, I guess you could say, the more variety, the better. I mean, species are lost, when there's become so few in that species that they don't have the genetic material to meet new odds. And evolution is going on all the time. We have to have the building blocks to change, and you can't do that if everybody's the same. So, I know that. Two more minutes. So go ahead.
Are people opposed? Well, I'm cloning myself instead of having a child with my wife. Are they opposed because they think I'm saying I'm somehow more superior? Do they think it's bad for society in general? Why do people oppose my choice to have a...
I think that's an excellent question. Any comments? Why is cloning bad? I mean, we all, not we all, but a lot of us say it is. I mean, it's playing God, or why is it bad? Comment?
I'm just going to ask you to repeat the question.
Oh, the question is, why is cloning bad? I mean, if I want to use my own cells to have an offspring instead of having it with a partner, why not? Yeah.
Implicit in the decision to clone is a decision to choose the genetic makeup of your child. And once you choose the genetic makeup of your child, you're not limiting yourself as to what your choice is. That is to say, there's no other ethical argument for choosing anything else besides that child than... Am I not communicating?
Are there any of us who have not chosen a partner based at least a little bit on the physical characteristics that we think will in their children?
But you're not. I mean, that rationale is completely different than choosing the exact genetic makeup of the child.
Well,
it's
the beginning.
But that's because I don't have her.
Yes.
I suspect one of the reasons, one of the reasons for against cloning is that there is a fantasy frequently behind it, not quite explicitly stated, which is if I clone myself, I will continue in that clone.
One of the problems with cloning is that it creates a monoculture, meaning that there isn't enough diversity, and if something is wrong with that monoculture, or there's like a mistake made in the cloning, then if you're doing more than one clone, it can cause all of them to die. If they're in a region susceptible to a disease that comes out, then it will kill off all of them, and not just one. And that's it's what's happening with GMOs in like grains and rice and stuff like that.
That's true. The comment is that you need diversity. The good example with crops, if you have really specialized wheat and the whole state of South Dakota is just one brand of wheat, a virus comes in and gets rid of that. Well, that was a potato blight in Ireland. And Ireland depends so much on the potato that when the potato blight came in, you know, there need to be a diversity of crops. The argument is we need a diversity of people to meet new challenges. If we're all cloned in one way, that clone may be great to run a marathon, but it's not going to be very good at figuring out how to deal with the pollution. However, that's society-wide. That doesn't answer the question of just me. I agree that cloning is not for everybody, but I want to clone myself. It's an awfully selfish thing to do.
So you may think that you could do a better job of raising yourself.
And with that comment, I'm going to have to put it in.